Hi, this is Paul Ingram of PainScience.com. This is your audio version of the post, Extra, Extra, Extra Floating Ribs Are Way More Common Than Anyone Knew. This post is huge. I think it's pushing, the audio is pushing 40 minutes, about 4,000 words, maybe, 15 or 20 minutes of reading. And this is the fourth time that I have recorded it, which is another record that I've broken. I didn't re-record because I was unhappy with the audio, but because I had to keep rewriting the post. It's really been a journey, this one, a steep learning curve, and in particular, when I was very close to publishing the last version, the penultimate version, I heard from the lead author of the study that I was writing about, and he pointed out a couple of significant errors. One was that I had misspelled his name. Oh, facepalm. It's one of the worst errors that I can make as a writer, especially when you send something to someone. Hey, I wrote about your thing, and you spell their name wrong. It's awful. Very cringe-inducing. But more importantly, he pointed out a basic error I'd made in my understanding. I really had something quite wrong, and I just had to throw out a third of the post, start over, reboot my comprehension of what I was writing about, add, I think, 1,000 words by the time I was done with that. And so, yeah, I couldn't just go with the third audio version. So at that point, I was already way down the rabbit hole. I was already thinking of it as a difficult post that had taken me, far too long to pull together. And then along comes this major revision at the last minute. So it's really been a tough one, but I also love the result. I've learned a lot. I've learned some neat stuff. It's neat science with neat implications, and it was a real pleasure to finally come to what felt like a good understanding of it. I think I'm there now. Coincidentally, an old friend has been suffering through a nasty example of the very problem that I've been writing about, slipped rib syndrome. The lower ribs are unstable at the best of times, and they can slide under a neighbor and pinch an intercostal nerve, among other discomforts. As always, a physical predicament like this in the body may or may not feel as bad as it sounds, depending on the metabolic context. But the result for my friend was a classic and severe blaze of intense pain around one side of his lower rib cage. That started suddenly for him, with no apparent provocation, a couple weeks ago, and it made his life hell for a few days. I was in so much pain I couldn't sleep, couldn't breathe properly, couldn't lie down or sit, couldn't really do anything, he told me. So he just sweated and squirmed his way through. It's been backing off this week, he said, but it's still bad. Greatly improved, but not over, and I would say now there is the potential for it to drag on and on for him. This was a new experience for my friend. He's never had this symptom before, but he has a form of muscular dystrophy that has already given him a lot of back trouble. And that condition, which is basically muscles not working, muscle weakness, probably increases the risk of this rib nonsense due to the weakness of the trunk musculature. But there's also a much more common risk factor that no doctor or physical therapist would have known about, because no one could have known about it without reading a recent study of the anatomy of the rib cage. You'd think that rib cage anatomy would be settled science, but nope. And that's what I was writing about. Not only is the lower rib cage an anatomically chaotic area, but specifically there are far more floating ribs down there than we see in the textbooks. And they are slippery. This is new anatomy that matters. And now a quote from Dr. Ian Griffiths, a podiatrist. This is from a 2011 blog post, and I've been quoting it ever since then. The word normal is probably an inappropriate word to apply to the human body. He was talking about foot arches, and today we're talking about ribs, but that quote is couldn't be more perfect for this topic. So it's getting routine for scientists to personally tell me about their research, which is delightful. Dr. Evert Erickson, trauma medical director at the Medical University of South Carolina, read my article about anatomical variation, which is an article all about the ways that anatomy differs from one person to the next. And he thought, I assume, I should tell this guy about my rib study. I bet he'll like that. And he did tell me, and I did like it. I liked it very much. One could hardly ask for a better example of an interesting and problematic body oddity. What Laswey et al. Found, that's Laswey's the first author. Dr. Erickson is the lead researcher, or the lead author. But Laswey's the first author, and you'll hear that name several times in this post. What they found studying the 8th, 9th, and 10th ribs in 40 cadavers was a lot more free 9th tips and entire floating 10th ribs than they were supposed to find. A whopping 59% of 40 cadavers had 3 fully floating ribs, 10, 11, and 12, rather than the officially standard pair, the pair that everybody learns when they study anatomy. They also found 86% of 9th ribs had a free tip, even though they were otherwise not true floating ribs. The 9th was always, 100% of the time, attached to the 8th by cartilage, but messily, and most of their tips were free floating. So the 9th is kind of a hybrid, partly a false rib, partly a floater. Which reminds me, we need to review some basic rib anatomy, true ribs versus false ribs versus floating ribs. The true ribs are directly joined to the sternum. The false ribs are indirectly joined to the sternum by cartilage, and the floating ribs are not attached to the sternum at all. So again, the 9th, kind of a bit of both. It's not quite a false, it's not quite a floater. I'm sure sometimes it's a false rib. And sometimes it's, never a floater, sometimes a false. Usually, 86% of the time, it's a hybrid. The general theme here is quite a lot more costal margin hypermobility and variability than expected. Even if their findings were exaggerated, they would still be interesting and important. The authors reasonably conclude that the 9th and 10th ribs are not invariably attached to the costal margin as described in anatomy books. And consistent with all of that floating and messy looseness of the lower ribs, Laswey et al. Also found plenty of subluxations and free and upwardly hooked tips, all potential sources of discomfort and pain, maybe downright likely sources. If free rib tips are more common than anyone realized, well, then so are the troubles they can cause. About the reliability or accuracy of the study, there's a couple of limitations, a couple of main ways that Laswey et al. Might have found more hypermobility in the cadavers they studied than actually exists in living people. Both of these limitations were acknowledged in the paper. First, the subjects were quite old, an average of 83 years at the time of death. And second, their dissection techniques could have actually created some of the hypermobility that they observed. But even if the findings are exaggerated, they're still they would still be significant, and none of that would affect their most amazing results. The limitations would not be relevant to the extremely high incidence of floating tenths that they found. So the new normal, 3 floating ribs, not 2. All of Laswey et al.'s findings may be anatomically significant, but the floating tenths thing is a bit of a bombshell. The paper is respectably calm and professional about it, reserved. I can make more of a fuss about it here because I think it deserves it. This is a pretty stunning finding. No one should be surprised that there are a few 10th ribs floating out there. Anatomical quirks are legion. But more than half, That's the surprise. More than half of tenths in their cadavers were floaters. And that's not a quirk. If true, it clashes with the textbooks and redefines normal. Redefining normal is tight. That's a reference to Pitch Meeting, my favorite comedic review channel. The tight thing is a running gag. He's got a disgusting movie exec character who at least once an episode says that something is tight. What I mean is that it's really neat when research challenges extremely long-term assumptions about anatomy. Look at most model skeletons or anatomical diagrams, and they will show you just two floating ribs. I checked several standard sources, and they all described only an 11th and a 12th floating rib, with the occasional mention of a rare, of quote-unquote rare, 10th floaters. Right? When it's mentioned, it's called rare. Above the 10th, the 9th rib is always depicted as a nice, tidy, false rib. So in addition to two floaters, we always have a nice, tidy 9th false, merging with the cartilage that links it to the sternum with no drama. A couple of examples here. I have two big textbooks in my library. Gray's Anatomy, the modern, a modern version. I don't think it's the most recent now, but a modern Gray's Anatomy, not the vintage one. And Netter's Atlas of Anatomy, which is next in line for most famous anatomy text. Gray's shows and definitively describes only two floaters in numerous diagrams with no mention of variation at all, not even rare. Doesn't even call it rare, just does not bring it up. And it's the same with Netter's. The floating ribs are just not represented. Extra floating ribs are often said to be common in the Japanese. This is a claim that's mentioned all over the internet, but it's only ever supported with one dubious old citation that I've not been able to find. It's in PubMed, but there's no abstract and no PDF floating around that I can find. So I have no idea what Shimaguchi et al. Actually says, but everyone cites it. And so you get things like this on Wikipedia. Wikipedia's rib cage page mentions floater variation, but only barely. They say that 10th floaters occur sometimes in several ethnic groups, most significantly the Japanese, but they don't actually even cite the Japanese study there. They just cite a textbook. Here's a fun bit, though. Wikipedia does show the original vintage version of Gray's rib cage, and that diagram, that very old anatomical drawing, that one does include three floaters, which is interesting. I mean, any anatomist or surgeon presumably has encountered these floaters, so somebody knew about this, but nobody knew how many of them there were. Gray drew a loose floating 10th, which is fascinating. While in all the modern renderings I checked, you have the conventional anatomy with a 9th and 10th being nice and tidy false ribs with no free tips. The reality, as reported by Laswey et al., is far messier and looser, with way, way more 9th and 10th rib tips roaming free than anyone has ever known. And that's true even if you cut the numbers in half or more. I guess I have to turn in my freak card. I have a lot of floating ribs. Bonus rib messiness here. This is not discussed by Laswey et al., but sometimes there's even an extra floating rib, the 13th. Several years ago, I discovered that I have both a floating 10th and a 13th floater. I marveled at how I'd missed those oddities for so many years. But who counts their floating ribs? Not me. Not even me. Not even with a long history of weird rib pain. Not even with a fascination with weird anatomy. It just didn't occur to me to check. Based on conventional anatomy, I assumed that my floating 10th was relatively rare. But with the 60% incidence identified by Dr. Erickson's group, a floating 10th is not just a quirk. It's actually how the spine models should be built. It's what should be in the texts. even if another study found much less, say just 40%, it's very clear that this anatomical bug slash feature is actually much more common than things like red hair, hazel eyes, or, like my wife, having a tongue long enough to touch the tip of your nose. She can actually do that. She can do it very easily. I can't come anywhere close. I have a stubby tongue, but my wife can and does show off her ability to do that effortlessly. So weird tongue, and I don't think that that's very common. I think it's probably quite a lot less common than 10th floating ribs. There are clearly a lot of floating ribs out there, probably a lot more than most physical therapists have ever imagined. So yeah, I guess I got to turn in my freak membership card, because a 10th rib, a 10th floater, is less exotic than having freckles. I have had many of the symptoms of slipped rib syndrome off and on for my entire life, gradually worsening over the years. Isn't normal anatomy fun? You know, my no longer freakish extra ribs have clearly been an issue for me. So it's time to talk about pathology, but first, another quote. This is Pennywise the Horror Clown, also known as It, from the novel of that name by Stephen King. Pennywise is famous for saying, 59% of us float down here. You might float too. So what could possibly go wrong? Well, basically more floaters equals more pathology. Subluxation, slipped rib syndrome, and hooked tips. That's what can go wrong. So slipped rib syndrome is the catch-all term for a mess of problems related to the looseness of the lower ribs and their stabby floating tips. By the way, this is very similar to Tietze syndrome and costochondritis, but not quite the same. All of these things concern the costal margin, but both Tietze and costochondritis affect the junction of the sternum with the costal cartilage. Tietze tends to be worse. It's ominously associated with things like infection, autoimmune disease, cancer, and for some weird reason it occurs almost entirely in the upper rib cage. Costochondritis is more like an arthritic flare-up, milder, more evenly distributed, can affect any of the joints of ribs with sternum. And slipped rib syndrome is clearly a sibling condition, but it does not affect a connection between the rib and the sternum. So these lower ribs, even with only the conventional anatomy in our mind, are obviously not exactly the most stable anatomy to begin with. I mean, it's right in the name. The floaters are especially wibbly-wobbly. They float. They're not well attached. The lower ribs are more chaotically and loosely attached to each other and the costal margin than any conventional anatomy has ever suggested, though. Probably even in healthy young people, just straight up genetics and anatomical variation. But age no doubt makes this worse, as their attachments to each other and to the costal margin loosen and break, the ribs sliding under and over each other a bit, and the tips in particular making trouble by poking intercostal nerves. Now, the end result of all that for many back pain patients, the end result for many patients is back pain, flank pain, some abdominal pain, and get this, occasionally even groin pain. As Laswey et al. Put this, quote, a complex pain response. Yeah, no kidding. There's a lot going on here. Unsurprisingly, symptoms are triggered by practically any movement or position of the trunk. You can get almost any combination of consistency, chronicity, and severity, which makes diagnosis quite challenging. Some people experience dramatic episodes of severe pain, like my friend, which might last for minutes or hours or days, but they can also be largely pain-free between episodes, or not. Others may live with milder and more erratic symptoms for many years, never knowing what's going on, and that has been my story. Probably for 20 years, I had basically no concept of any of this, and yet I had the symptoms, and they weren't bad enough to, you know, ever take to a healthcare professional. They were an annoyance, an just an odd annoyance, occasionally severe, but only very temporarily severe. So I didn't even attempt to get it diagnosed, really, never mind succeeding. So the symptoms of slip-drip syndrome are as variable as the anatomy because the pathogenesis equation is freakishly complex. There are at least four ways that these loose ribs can cause trouble. In summary, subluxation, intercostal neuropathy, inflammation around the rib tips, and cranky muscle. And let's go back and explore those in a little more detail. So first, subluxation, which is partial, just partial dislocation. That's all that means. Partial displacement. That's the most obvious and distinct thing that can go wrong. This is not joint subluxation we're talking about. It's not a spinal issue. The costa vertebral joints and back may also get irritated, and they might get irritated with or without their own subluxation in the same way that I don't have to dislocate a knuckle for it to ache with arthritis. But Lasway et al. Did not study the posterior joints. They were only looking at the costal margin, only the anterior anatomy. So we're talking about displacement, dislocation, subluxation of the ribs themselves, which can cross over each other like fingers. Lasway et al. Found this in 19% of ninth ribs, despite the fact that they're not true floaters, and that they're attached, they're at least partially attached, and yet still dislocated. They also found 33% incidence of subluxation of the 10th ribs. And that was the number whether the rib was floating or not, and not all of those subluxations were internal subluxations. Not all displacements of the rib go inward, which is the only way that the intercostal nerve can get squeezed. They can also go the other way. They can also go out, slip up and over an adjacent rib instead of down or in and under. So that incidence of subluxation, that's just as startling as the incidence of 10th floaters, and not a coincidence. It's very direct evidence that floaters are linked with pathology. That both the floaters and their problems are more common than we knew. Intercostal neuropathy. This occurs when a rib subluxation pinches an intercostal nerve. This usually feels like a burning pain in a stripe around one side of the torso, but it's not always that simple. For instance, the 12th intercostal nerve is linked to the first lumbar nerve. So you get some bonus neuropathy, which can lead to pain in the groin and the lower abdomen. And so we get a subtype of slipped rib syndrome, 12th rib syndrome, and that significantly complicates the presentation of this condition. If you can get a little bit of first lumbar nerve neuropathy going along with your intercostal neuropathy, things get much weirder. Of course, you don't have to pinch a nerve for the rib tips to cause trouble. You can just get inflammation. Any rib with a pointy end, paging Arias Stark, can irritate the tissue around it. So there's undoubtedly a certain amount of that as well. And by the way, I think that this is mainly what happens to me. I think I basically get occasionally something in there slips and pinches something, is painful, but I don't think it's neuropathy. It just is a very sharp pain right there around the tip of my 10th. Last thing is cramping muscle, exhausted sensitive muscle. That's another likely factor here, certainly as a complication, but also possibly as a cause or a perpetuating factor. The body probably tries to stabilize and immobilize painfully displaced ribs by tightening up the area, which could lead to fatigue and irritation as a consequence. The intercostal muscles in particular can become extremely sensitive, and muscle dysfunction, cramping, and or weakness might also predispose someone to subluxing in the first place. How many ribs, which were fine, have been pulled out of place by a bit of muscle spasm? or chronic tightness. So if there are more floating ribs than we thought, more free tips, then all of these predicaments are probably also more common and more severe. And I'll close this section with yet another pop culture reference this time. It's Arya Stark from Game of Thrones by George Martin. Quote, "Stick 'em with the pointy end." A very famous Arya quote, except it's not actually Arya, it's Jon Stark. Jon teaches her. He says it when he's teaching her how to use her famous sword, Needle. And then we remember it as an Arya quote because she repeats it to someone else later. We remember it because she's cute and her delivery is great. So it's an Arya quote, "Stick 'em with the pointy end." Hooked tips on the tense. So here's yet another interesting variation that Laswey et al. Found. That's 10% of 10th ribs having a hooked tip. And 10% is quite common. 1 in 10 people is plenty of people. The hook is a cartilaginous extension to the 10th rib that curves upwards towards the 9th. This is nicely depicted in Gray's drawing above, the vintage one, that wicked-looking curved extension to the rib. What I find fascinating about this is that the hook is so clearly just an incomplete cartilaginous connection to the costal margin. Rather than merging with the rib or cartilage above, it just falls short of it to some degree, which makes the 10th a floating rib rather than a false rib because it's not connecting. But it's a floating rib with a barb of cartilage pointed directly at the underside of the 9th rib, and therefore free to slip over it or under it. Indeed, over 60% of 10th ribs with hooks were also displaced. So do you know where the tip of your 10th rib is? Are rib subluxations a thing? Some skepticism about the skepticism. I have seen several knee-jerk skeptical takes about rib subluxations over the years, always overconfidently declaring that they're not a thing. Scoffing at the unknown is not exactly skepticism putting its best foot forward. Like so many other things in musculoskeletal medicine, it simply hasn't been studied much. As Laswey et al. Have shown, we didn't even have the basic anatomy. So scoffing is probably premature. The skepticism is mostly aimed at subluxations of the joints between the spine and the ribs and tends to ignore what we're talking about today. Displacement of the rib bodies is not usually the subject of this skepticism. I've certainly had my own suspicions about those kinds of rib subluxations with the joints with the spine, mainly because of their conceptual and anatomical proximity to chiropractic, to the intervertebral subluxations, and some of the worst chiropractic nonsense that has come from that idea. But I carefully and consciously, for years now, curbed my skepticism about rib subluxation until I knew more. And I wish that skeptics as a group would do a little more of that. I think that reserving judgment is a very skeptical thing to do. It's a very important critical thinking skill, and I wish more skeptics would exercise it and practice it. It might help a bit to undo our very strong reputation for throwing babies out with the bathwater. Now, granted, there are probably far more chiropractors opportunistically exaggerating rib subluxations and profitably overstating their ability to fix them. Then there are cynics underestimating it and rolling their eyes. So that needs to be said. But I'm now fairly sure myself that the truth is in the middle. I think clinically significant rib subluxations probably do exist. A proper ontological audit would call for a whole nother article, and I will probably write that someday. But today is not that day. For now, I will just say that I have seen enough evidence-based reasons to suspect that rib subluxations are a legit phenomenon. I've also seen an awful lot of anecdotes that are kind of hard to explain without rib subluxations, including quite a few of my own experiences, of course. I have much less faith that anyone can reliably put those ribs back where they belong, but I am now quite confident that the need is real. I'll throw in an extra thought here that just occurred to me for the first time, despite more revision and editing of this post than any other post in memory. This just occurred to me just now. Probably the tip of the iceberg principle applies. We know that severe slipped rib syndrome is a thing because, you know, surgeons go in and actually repair it. Well, I should qualify that. Just because surgeons do something does not mean that they're solving a real problem. But there's a very high confidence that yes, intercostal neuropathy is a thing that can happen with severe rib subluxations, for sure. But the tip of the iceberg principle applies because usually when there's a dramatic example of a problem that we know about, then there's almost always a more common, milder version of it. And you can just kind of take it as a given that if something can happen in a bad way, then it probably happens in a minor way all the time without diagnosis. Therapy for rib subluxations. This was another big revision moment for me. The original version of this just reported on the anatomy, and at some point I realized I really can't I can't write about anatomy that matters. I can't write about anatomical variation that has, you know, significant clinical implications without also saying something about what can you possibly do about it. Of course, as usual in this field, not much. The options aren't great. I'm not aware of any evidence-based conservative therapy for rib subluxation. But I do think that we can easily apply some sensible principles to the problem. We can take our best shot, and it's probably worthwhile, worth trying. And self-treatment in this case is probably often preferable to trying to get professional help, because professional help could so easily be overkill, because the pros really don't know much about this. And so if you try to get help with it, you're just maybe adding hassle and expense for very little additional gain. To say nothing of the perpetual risk of wasting money on all the silliness that pollutes all the physical therapy professions. Buyer beware. The same looseness that makes these joints prone to trouble might also mean that for some lucky patients, it is relatively easy for them to go back where they belong. The trick is, you know, how do we encourage that? What can we do that might help a rib get back to normal? I think there's at least four things that have the potential to normalize rib position. Mobilizations, massaging the intercostals, mobilizing the costovertebral joints, and hot soaking. A little more about each of those. Mobilizations, that's also known as dynamic joint mobility drills. And all I'm talking about here is active stretching, basically. Rhythmically twist, bend, flex, stretch the lower back and abdomen. I mean, you're really just pulling on the ribs gently and rhythmically and over again. Little sessions, you know, a minute here, several times per day. Just get up from your desk or step away from whatever you're doing, walk away from the bandsaw, and do some hip circles. Just swing your hips in a circle, and that will massage with movement the musculature of the low back and the abdomen, which is where the ribs live. Getting a little more detailed, I think this probably has the most potential, is massaging the intercostal muscles, which is easy to do in front. They're very easy for you to get a thumb between the ribs on the front for self-massage, but it gets a lot more awkward the further around back you get and the higher you get. Now, you might think going around the back that you're getting less relevant, but I think that the posterior is relevant. And this is the muscles in the back and the joints with the spine are part of the equation here. And so I think that anything that helps to normalize function, soothe, ease, relax, any of the musculature that controls rib position, including the musculature in back. I think that it's all worth doing. You can also use a foam roller or a ball on the back to flex and push the rib joints themselves around a bit with pressure beside the spine. The posterior rib joints are, again, not the focus of this article, but I do still think they're relevant. They are the fulcrum for rib movement. And by the way, you can't do this by pressing directly beside the spine. That will be wasted because the joint is hidden behind thick muscle, very thick muscle, and the vertebrae. So you can't touch it. You have to press on the ribs a little further out, about 2 to 4 inches from the center, roughly where you can first feel them as they emerge from behind the thick column of paraspinal musculature right beside the spine. So you can't actually press on the joint directly, so instead you push on the rib as close to that as you can get, as close to the joint as you can get. And fortunately, all of this happens quite naturally and easily with a foam roller because these ridges stick out and the roller just naturally falls onto them. So if you just put a foam roller under your back and roll back and forth, you are doing exactly the right thing. If it's a ball, you have to be a little more precise with your aim. Finally, hot soaking. Any relaxing heat, of course, could be helpful here, but in this case, actual immersion might be even more helpful because of the supportive buoyancy. But of course, standard heat warning, never use heat if it's not appealing. That could harm rather than help if something is sufficiently inflamed. But I think that that's probably quite rare. In most cases, bath heat is going to be fine or appealing. If you like a hot bath, you'll probably like it in this situation. For bonus points, you can combine the last two, massage in a bath, specifically rolling on a rubber ball beside the spine to flex those rib joints in that warm, safe-feeling, buoyant context. This is something I call the bath trick, which is, I wrote a whole article about it many years ago, which seems kind of quaint to me now. It's just this very simple little massage idea that I devoted an entire page to. It's a fraction the size of this blog post. But I still use the bath trick. I did it yesterday for the first time in a couple months. But I still use that trick for my ribs for this purpose. You'll notice if I haven't lost you, if you've been paying attention, you'll notice that these are all just ways of relaxing and wiggling the anatomy. That's it. It's nothing fancy. You're basically just stimulating the displaced rib and hoping it goes back where it belongs. If you can think of other ways of just relaxing and wiggling the anatomy, by all means, go for it. And that's the end of my fourth reading of this post, which I feel like I could almost recite by now, except that it wasn't the same each time I read it. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.